So as we look at the first paragraph of Megillah, you wonder about a lot of things. Well, let's try. Baruch Hashem, we just put up many, many questions on the board. A lot of good questions. And a number of the questions we'll see are going to coalesce are one or two key ideas. And just to highlight some of them. Right away, the first pasuk with Achashverosh, who Achashverosh? We're so used to that term. We've heard it so many tens of times that we're used to it, but it's really an awkward phrasing. Then you come to the second pasuk, and as was several of you pointed out, the second pasuk, hard to know what the purpose of the second pasuk is. Bechlal, Melech HaChashverosh was Al Kisei Malchusor Asher B'Shushan HaBira. He was sitting on his throne. That's not particularly surprising, nor is it particularly interesting. And his throne happened to be Shushan HaBira. The language is strange, the content we don't understand. And then we come to the two parties. And you pointed out correctly that the second party, which was for the masses, the hoi polloi, it gets much more description in the Megillah than the first party. As Yehuda and others pointed out, there's a tremendous amount of detail about these parties, particularly the second party. The Chur, the Karpas, the Trelas, if you go to the excavations at Persepolis, you can see which is the location of another major Persian imperial palace. The size was overwhelming, incredibly large. And if you go to the Met, if you're not a Kohen and you go to the Met, you can see what Rizpas Bahat is. They have these gorgeous alabaster tiles. This is like the wealth here is overwhelming, but the detail is also overwhelming. You're wondering, why do we care? There are many other royal scenes described in Tanakh. I think few, if any, have this level of exquisite detail. And as a matter of fact, you even wonder that the Pesukim actually say, Oshe Pasik Dalet, Oshe Kfon Machuso, Yikar Teferes Gedulaso. It's all about showing the wealth and showing the glory, what's going on. And then there are also a lot of details. Pasuk Hey, there's more about where people are located, the second party. They're in the Chatzar Ginas Bisan HaMelech. In the courtyard, sounds like the courtyard that surrounded, that led into the royal garden. Why is that significant? As an aside, the introduction to the Masada Rav Kook edition of Megillas Esther, in the Dat Nikra series, they point out that if you look at modern archaeological excavations, you can map out exactly what's being described in the Megillah. You see exactly how it corresponds to what was there. Which makes perfect sense because we believe that that Megillas Esther was written by Mordechai and Esther, who lived at the time, who saw the palace and were describing what they saw with their own eyes. Additional archaeological support for what we know from the Tanakh. And then all this detail about the drinking and how the drinking was done. Hashtiyah kadas eino nes, no one's being forced in the different kingdom. Why is that important? Why do we care? And then, as you point out, as you progress later, you have the whole Vashti story. You have the whole story with Vashti. And you'll notice, by the way, that her name changes. Someone had pointed out before, Achashverosh, Melech Achashverosh, Vashti Hamalka, versus Hamalka Vashti. Right? In Pasig Tes, the first time you meet her, Vashti Hamalka also made a Mishtei Nashim. And in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Achashverosh asks that they bring Vashti Hamalka once again before the Melech. But in Pasuk Yud Veiz, she refuses. Who refuses? Not Vashti Hamalka, but Hamalka Vashti. And then, as you pointed out, we progress, there's this trial, and all of a sudden we're hearing the names of many, many people. And we're back to Vashti HaMalka. And then finally we come to the end, and the parak ends with this absurd edict. Not really sure what to make of this. And it just sort of drops us off. And then, in addition to all these specific questions, as you pointed, there's a global question, which is, what's this parak all about? That very, very fundamental Gemara Megillah. That one of the most basic elements of your toolbox, your methodology toolbox in learning Tanakh, is to recognize that anything that's in the Tanakh has eternal significance. Where? Why? The rest of the story of Megillah, I understand. We need to know that Vashti died, and Ahasuerus is in need of a new king. But is there anything more than that? Some Midrash has some opinions in the Midrash, because some of them are quoted in the Gemara, understand that the Seuda was the cause of all this, in the sense that the Gzeiras Haman may have been punishment for the chet that the Jewish people committed in participating in the Seuda. That's driven by this kasha, which is, why is this here? Why is this here? Talderach drash, on level of drash, additional levels of interpretation, so there are opinions in Chazal. Some people in Chazal understand that it's here to explain the justice background. This was the chet which warranted Gzeiras Haman as an onesh. Here you go. The simcha. What else is going on here? So I want to share with you a stunning, stunning, stunning approach to the Malbim, who addresses that whole host of specific questions and addresses as well the larger question. Well, he addresses the specific questions. I think if we take a step back, once we have his approach to all the details, we may be able to piece together. I think we may emerge not only with sensitivity to details, and a renewed sensitivity for the details that we tend to ignore, and we'll hopefully emerge with specific terutzim to specific kashas, and we may also emerge with an understanding of what Esther Perek Aleph alone is all about. Because I would suggest, and I think we'll see this develop, that it could be that the first Perek of Esther stands on its own. In addition to being the setup for the rest of the Megillah, there's a lot to be learned just from the first Perek of Esther. Kishel Asa, as a work unto itself, it already has a transom out to teach us. So let's dive in. The Malbim makes the following core suggestion, and once you accept his yesod, a lot falls into place. The Malbim suggests, his whole approach to the Megillas Esther is, in general, incredibly mechudash, very, very satisfying, and with incredible fealty to the words. He's very concerned that let's actually look at what the Pesukim said. And he has other Chiddushim later in the Megillah, very, very fascinating. But for now, let's focus on Perek Rishon. And let's start with one more question that we did not mention before. And that is to take a look at Pasuk Gimel. The first party, right? The 180-day party. Let's look at the invitation list for a moment. Vishnah Shaloshim Malcho Asav Mishnah L'chol Sarav Avadav. He makes a Mishnah for all of his Sarim, for all of his Avadim. Chel Parasu Madai, the soldiers of the Persian Empire, Hapartimim, and the Sari Hamidinos. So we're inviting the court page, we're inviting the footmen, we're inviting the slaves, we're inviting the privates and corporals in the Persian army, and also we're inviting all the ministers and governors of different provinces throughout the empire. Anything strikes you as strange about that? Protocol? You invite the hired help in the palace before you invite the minister of Ethiopia, before you invite the minister of Gaul, the minister of India? Really? That seems like a total inversion of Derech Eretz. Says Malbim, exactly. That's exactly the order you would think it. This is a royal affair. Protocol is everything. You know, who goes first and who goes second? What's going on here? Why did the Pesukim bother to tell us who was invited to Bechlal? Not only do they tell us, but they tell us in sequence, which is incredibly strange. And the Malbim suggests that that sequence actually is one of the keys to understanding the entire first parak. Because the Yesod he puts out is you have to understand there are two types of monarchy. There is what we would call, in our terminology, a constitutional monarchy and an absolute monarchy. There could be a monarch who is powerful but has to contend with, again, obviously anachronistic uses terminology, but checks and balances. And a monarch who shares his power with other bodies of government. And there's a monarch who is total, who's absolute. The constitutional monarch typically we understand as a well-paid CEO. The absolute monarch is the owner. The constitutional monarch has a lot of power, but there are rules in which he works, and he has to interact with other people. And the way the Malbim lays out four or five nafkaminas between a constitutional monarch and an absolute monarch. Number one, who owns the money? Who owns the treasury? Is the treasury entrusted to the king to use on behalf of the people, or is the treasury the king's personal slush fund that he owns and can do with as he wishes? Number two, does the king need to consult with a council, with a senate, with advisors? Or is he just totally in charge and does whatever he pleases? He may want to, for his own good, bounce things off of other people, but he's holding all the chips. Number three, is he bound by the law? Now, those are three big issues. Money. Power. Does he have it all or not? And is he bound by the law? And then the fourth thing is capital. Does he, if he's part of a larger governmental structure, the capital is where it is. If he's an absolute monarch, he can choose to live wherever he wishes. Achashverosh, the Malbim suggests, is interested in making a shift. He was married to Vashti, whom Chazal tell us was a great granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. She was his ticket to the throne. He married up in a very big way. Some midrashim understand that he was born a commoner, perhaps even had worked at a menial job for many years, and he married up tremendously. Marries into the imperial family and is vaulted to power. And now he's interested. He has it all. He's the emperor of the Persian Empire, which was, at the time, the most powerful empire, certainly in the Eastern Hemisphere. Right? He rules over thousands of miles. And still, it's not good enough. Yishei Shalmana wrote some aside. He has it all, he wants more. Well, what more is there to have? He got it all. But let's move it up. I want to be it. I don't want to just be a limited monarch over this entire empire. I want all the power. I don't want to owe it to my wife. The royal blood of Nebuchadnezzar courses through her veins. I don't want to owe it to anyone else. I want to make it clear. I want to go for the gold. I want total domination. That's what Achashverosh is saying to himself. How is he going to do it? He has a bold plan. I'm going to do something that will be so overwhelming, will make it so overwhelmingly obvious that my monarchy is absolute, no one will doubt it. So I'm going to make not a nice party, not an amazing party, but a party the likes of which no one has seen before. A six-month party. That's just absurd. A six-month party. And the expenditures were just through the roof. But think about that. And you can imagine, Malcolm says, you know, the Minister of the Treasury is saying, the Ministry of the Exchequer, if you will, saying, Your Majesty, you know, we have to talk about budgeting. Budgeting? What do you mean budgeting? This is my money. I'm in charge. Council? Advisors? I'm making the calls here. Power? That invitation list. It's there's nothing, the Gemara is the machlokas whether he was a tipish or a chacham. The Malbim definitely goes the approach that is extraordinary, perhaps there was a little bit of both, as we'll see. But certainly there's extraordinary chachma. There's extraordinary cunning, and this is almost Machiavellian in terms of his cynical use of political manipulation. Right? We're going to make a party so obviously over the top, it will redefine what it means to be over the top. Right? And the invitation list, bidavka. I'll invite the senators, I'll invite the governors, but they're nothing special. They'll come after the people who work for me. The lowliest slave who works for me personally, my own soldiers are going to come first because it's all about me. The governors hold no power anymore. This is a very bold statement that I'm in charge, absolutely, totally. I'm in charge, no sarma of any power. Sarma Medinos are holding no chips. I'm in charge and I'm total control over the treasury. The Bible suggests it may even have been a move to the new palace. And that may be to a new location at Susa, at Shushan, which may be exactly the significance of Perek Beis. In Perek Aleph, he's still insecure. He's Achashverosh, who's Molech Mehudu Vat Kush, but he had a history. He had been playing Achashverosh before he became Emperor Achashverosh. And he's grappling with that. So first he makes a move to a new location, that's what the Malbim theorizes, and then comes this massive party. The money, the power, the invitation list, everything makes it so clear. And then, in case you didn't get the message, a total violation of what had been royal protocol, he makes a party for the common people. Everyone who lives in Shushan HaBira. Right? You're asking for Shushan HaBira, what's that all about? Right? Because if you live in my city, you're special. It doesn't matter whether you used to be here, here, or here in the pecking order. There is no pecking order. It's me and everyone else. Everyone works for me. I have all the power. No one else has any power. That's what Achashverosh is driving at. So if you live in my city, you deserve a party. And obviously there was also, presumably, a larger movement. Historians of American politics have documented that from the very earliest campaigns, free food, big rallies have always played a role. I forget that, but when Adams and Jefferson, the first contested election in 1800, they have records of like incredible amounts of food and drink, and it wasn't just orange juice that was being served at these big rallies. So that minute goes back not hundreds of years on both sides, but thousands of years. Obviously, he's built up his base, Achashverosh, but obviously he's also trying to... trying to establish that he is fully, fully in charge. Yeah.
Was Shushan the capital before Achashverosh?
The Malbim assumes it may not have been. The Malbim argues that that Pasuk Beis is recording a move to Shushan.
From where?
He says it had been in Bavel, and they moved it to Shushan, or perhaps in Persepolis, and they moved it to Shushan. And then we understand also the descriptions of the second party are even more lavish to make it clear how much he was spending on people who in the past had been quote unquote nothing special. The ordinary people didn't get royal treatment. But Achashverosh says, look, you're all equally deserving of royal treatment because I hold all the chips and none of you knows. You're no less deserving than the governors. You're no less deserving than the senators. You're no less deserving than the partim and the sarim. And the fact that they were allowed into Chatzar Ginas Pisan HaMelech, that he decided, well, the laws don't apply to him, the rules don't apply to him, we can let commoners into areas of the palace that had formerly been reserved for VIPs only. They had so many kalim, they stopped the usual rules. Gemara records in Masechet Brachos that even many centuries later, Persians were known for their exquisite sense of Derech Eretz, particularly while eating. And a sense of, Gemara talks about their sense of propriety about sequence and who goes first and who goes second. That was a part of Persian culture, going back thousands of years. So Malbim suggests that probably was true not only in B'tkufas HaTalmud, but several centuries earlier, in the time of Purim, and Achashverosh was dafka saying, no, number one, on the invite list for the first party, the order is totally reversed, and then at the second party, no one has to wait for anyone else to drink. There are enough kalim, there's no ones, and there's no das, and there's so many kalim, and everyone just drinks whenever, however they want. No one's waiting for anyone else. I don't have to defer to you. Because again, reinforcing Nachash Meirish's message, other than me, no one deserves kavod, because all the kavod goes to me. And other than Nachash Meirish, everyone is all the same. Not because everyone's going to get so much respect, but everyone's going to get so little respect. And then we understand, if we understand what Nachash Meirish is trying to accomplish with this party, this is an incredibly cunning, strategic move. There's, two can play at this game. Vashti realizes that her leverage is quickly eroding. And so she decides that I'm going to make a party too. Because, you know, where do you think you're going, Achashverosh? Your ticket, I'm your ticket to royalty is because you're married to me. Let's not forget that. So she says she wants to make her own party. And to which Achashverosh responds, and again, these details that we tend to ignore. Pasuk says, Vashti HaMalka makes the party, specific, but she's only allowed to do it, apparently, Beis HaMachos Asher LaMalach Achashverosh. It has to be on Achashverosh's turf. Those are Achashverosh's ground rules. And at this point, she's Vashti HaMalka. And then to stress the fact, Achashverosh's counter moves to Vashti's attempt to assert herself are, number one, you're going to be in on my turf. And number two, his demand that she appear, right, on day seven. What's that all about? V'haros ha'amim v'asrim esyafya ki tovas mar'ehi. Show up wearing your crown, and let everyone see how gorgeous you are. So it may just be a drunken man, a debased man, just trying to show off his trophy wife. The Malbim suggests there probably was an element of that, and there's also incredible political nuance here. Because he wants to make it clear, oh, Vashti, yeah, I married her because she's so pretty, because I'm so powerful, so I just got to pick the prettiest girl. It's all about her looks. Don't think that I need her for power. I'm powerful because of me, and that's it. And that's why to cement that, he says she's going to appear and show off how pretty she is. And now, it's not Vashti HaMalka who refused to come. Who refused to come? HaMalka Vashti. Like HaMelech HaHashverosh, HaMalka Vashti. She says, no, I'm the queen. Queen first. I'm not coming. I'm not playing your game. And that's part, it becomes a subtle pitched political battle between husband and wife over the nature of Achashverosh's career, the nature of Achashverosh's role. What sort of emperor is he? And then, so that's already fascinating. And then let me share with you one more twist of the Malbim, and then we'll take a step back. Malbim says, so how did everything play out? So on the one hand, Achashverosh is very upset. You're undoing everything I'm trying to accomplish here. In one fell swoop, billions of dollars were spent, the equivalent probably of billions of dollars. Like, party. 187 days of feeding probably thousands of people at the highest level of cuisine possible. Like, look at that. The cost of that is staggering. Pashut staggering. I think when they have an inaugural, presidential inaugural ball, how much they spend on one day, several parties over the course of a day or two, more than half a year of partying, the cost must have been staggering. And now it's all going to be at the last minute, on day seven, day 187, Vashti refuses to show up. So he flips his lid, and that's the end of her. But then, what was that we hear about the, she's being judged by the Ro'eh Pnei HaMelech. The Ro'eh Pnei HaMelech. And all of a sudden, it's being judged specifically by this new group that see the face of the king. She suggests means, al pipshuto, that they know how to read the king's facial expressions. They know him well. Hayoshvim Rishon Abamachus. They're always front row with the king. They see the king's face. He specifically picks a panel of judges who will understand what he's trying to say. He doesn't really want Vashti to be killed because that probably as his wine wears off, he's like, I don't want to lose her. To say that he loved her would probably be giving way too much credit to Achashverosh. He lusted after her, but he liked having her around. He was not a man that does not strike us as a person who deeply empathizes with other people and truly cared about his wife. But he found her useful and fun to have around. That's probably about the moral level that Achashverosh is operating at, unfortunately. But he wants, and you'll notice even when the charge is read, Pasuk Tezayin, what are we going to do with Hamalka Vashti, who didn't follow Melech Achashverosh, but Yad HaSarisim? All of a sudden there's a stress that the message had been delivered via the Sarisim. It hadn't been given directly by Achashverosh. Almost like Achashverosh is already trying to sort of walk things back a little bit. Well, it's not even so bad. And he assumed that you seven guys will understand. Obviously, we need to go through a process. We can't let this go unpunished because that would work against me. But we're going to handle this like, you know, it's a small... I mean, she must have misunderstood. Right? We're gonna spin it. Oh, it's Biyala Sarisim. And Achashverosh is upended in this by whom? Exactly. Memuchan says, well, this is a major issue. This is a national political issue. We can't let this go. This is going to ruin your power. It's going to ruin the whole power structure. And Achashverosh says no choice. Now, Memuchan has played Achashverosh's game against Achashverosh himself. And Memuchan has gotten Achashverosh to, well, if you so need the power, this is a major issue. We've got to do something about it. Manly honor throughout the empire. Whatever. This is a major political statement. You need to take a strong stand. Boxing Achashverosh into responding in a way he really doesn't want to do. And finally, Achashverosh, the Malbim suggests, ends the perek by taking another suggestion or two of Memuchan's, which is that you are going to take this opportunity to further cement your power by issuing a unilateral royal edict. No Senate, no council, no Noam. You're in charge. You're going to show that you're in charge by issuing an edict unilaterally, without anyone else's involvement, anyone else's approval. You're going to give a Dvar Malchus. Boom. That's what the king says, and that's it. And that's his final edict at the end, which was presumed to be a pretty popular one. All the men, and it will be popular among the men anyhow. Reaffirming that men are in charge. That was assumed to be a popular move before women's suffrage. Only men would be voting, so to speak. And the men will all like this. And this will be a first edict by the king himself alone, supreme. And utterly absurd. Right. If you think about it, Rabbi Osai, we just worked through the Malbim's approach to the so many tens of details throughout the parak. And already, as I said before, the parak Mamar sings. All of a sudden, so many details. I didn't have a chance to go through the Malbim. It goes through Mamar line by line by line. I tried to give you the broad strokes. But once you have this yisod, that what Achashverosh is grappling with is how much power will he have. So many lines, everything, the whole parak sings. All the details are there. You begin to see how this is important and that's important. It's all painting the picture. All it is Achashverosh is trying to accomplish. And I promised before, not only would we have a yesod which would explain a lot of details, but hopefully we could also take a step back to understand the bigger picture. And to understand, perhaps, what is the goal of the whole parak. And does the parak, as I suggested before, maybe, in addition to being the prelude to the story of Esther, it may have significance in its own right. So what I would suggest, and then after that I would love to take questions, is that once you go, Adkan Divri HaMalbim, that I would suggest, once you have the Malbim's approach, look at the parak as a whole. What do we have? It's a sketch of a man who thinks that he can aggregate all the power in his own hands. He can collect all of it. He has so many chips, he wants to have them all. He wants to be totally in charge. And he tries very hard. And he wastes billions of dollars in modern terms to achieve that goal. Ironically, by the time the parak was over, his goal was to be totally in charge of everyone else. By the time the parak is over, he is the least in charge. Everyone else is playing him. Vashti is pulling his strings. Memuchan is pulling his strings. His insecurities, which we saw already according to Malbim in the very opening first half of Pasuk, he's Achashverosh, who is Achashverosh, who's Molech, but he has a history as being just Achashverosh, a commoner, and that insecurity that he's trying to escape, instead of handling a healthy way, he's trying to just make himself in charge of everyone else. You can try, but the irony is he attempts to be the most in charge. He ends up being the most not in charge. He ends up being controlled by everyone else. It's not the same as, but it's a cousin to an irony we've discussed in the past elsewhere in Tanakh, with Yonah and with Paro and Moshe, how whatever Avinir discusses in the Shurim on Yonah, how Kadosh Baruch Hu will give us the Bechir Chafshes to choose to do particular things, but at the same time his goals will be achieved. And not only despite what we do, but as a matter of fact, even if we try to act against his goals, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's goals will be achieved through, ironically, through what we do. Now, Yonah is trying to avoid inducing non-Jews to do tshuva. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows him to run the opposite direction, to get in a boat going west instead of going northeast to Nineveh. But ironically, it's through his very flight on the boat that he ends up being successful at getting Anshei Nineveh to do tshuva. Number one, on the boat itself, while he's trying to escape, he's inducing the people on the boat to do tshuva. And according to Radak, the only reason why they listened to him when he got to Nineveh and didn't dismiss him as some anonymous crazy who claims that he had nevuah, the only reason why they understood that he was for real and his words had impact is because they heard the whole story from the sailors about the miracle on the boat. But they were never going to hear from him because he's dead. He shows up, he has a captive audience. So it's not only that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's goal of Tshuvas HaNachrim was accomplished despite Yonah's attempt to escape, but it was actually accomplished through Yonah's attempt to escape. And the same, I think, we discussed about Paro. According to Ibn Ezra, that Moshe has raised HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan for Moshe to be raised in Beis Paro so that he would get the training, the political skill and the attitudes and the self-confidence, the personality to ultimately be a Manig Yisrael, to be the leader of Klal Yisrael, to be Moshe and Shal Yisrael. He got that out, according to Ibn Ezra, was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's goal in placing Moshe into Beis Paro. So the profound irony is Paro, according to Chazal, is trying to... The whole Gezerah about throwing the babies into the Ur was in order to destroy Moshe and Shal Yisrael. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed him to do his heinous infanticide. Thousands of times it made. Who knows? Heinous murder. And yet, it was through, not despite that decree, but actually through that decree that Yocheved ends up putting Moshe in the river where he gets picked up by Bas Paro and vaulted straight into Beis Paro where he is raised to be Moshe and Shal Yisrael. The irony of the Soda Hashgacha. So there is a somewhat parallel, not the same, but a somewhat parallel irony here. Achashverosh has plans that he's going to be it. But if that's not, Atas Hashem Hisakum. As long as HaKadosh Baruch Hu has in mind, all the gaiva and all the taiva ends up totally backfiring in the most dramatic, absurd way possible. Right? Vashti is pulling his strings. He can kill Vashti, but look how he ends up plans askew. And then Memuchan plays Achashverosh so Achashverosh thinks he's in charge. By the time Memuchan is done with him, not only has he killed the wife he wants to save in pursuit of the power he thinks he can get, but in pursuit of ultimate power, he makes a royal fool of himself by issuing an edict that Memuchan convinced him that he's going to, establish himself as the ultimate power by giving it to Dvar Malchus, which makes him look like the ultimate idiot. Really? That you use your power to make a rule that about what language people should speak in bilingual homes? Really? The most absurd thing possible. So I would suggest, in addition to everything that the first paragraph does in terms of laying the groundwork as a preface, as a prelude for the for the rest of the Megillah. It could be that in Perek Rishon stands alone. There's a Hutzrach HaLadoros, there's a Tachlis, and just Perek Rishon alone. It's a sketch of Gaiva. It's almost a caricature. It's true. But it shows you how absurd people can be in their yearning for power and for Gaiva in the most foolish ways. And how it's like you think you're grabbing power when all you're doing is exactly the opposite. When everyone else you're empowering everyone else to be in charge of you, you're making yourself look absurd, and I would take it one step further. Derech Mashal is also true. It has a lot to do with how we engage not only power, but how we engage particular desires, particular appetites that we have. And the question of whether we engage Tanuge Olam Hazeh in a controlled, self-disciplined way, and I'm making decisions about how and when and in what way and what context I'm going to engage a particular pleasure in a happy, healthy, holy way, or am I just going to think that I'm being totally free by engaging my appetites in an unfettered way, but in fact, I might think now I have total power. Because now everything is just free, I can do whatever I want. When people do whatever they want, they end up being far less free, and they end up looking often very absurd, like Ahasuerus. And the fellow who thinks that he's gonna shove it to his parents by smoking up and shooting up, because he's going to do whatever he wants, he thinks that by developing a drug addiction, he's now more free. Right? When in fact, the opposite is true. Now you're more shackled than you ever were before. Now you're not in charge of your heroin is in charge of you. And you end up in your pursuit of being in charge of the world and being in charge of your own world, you end up looking, destroying your world, and end up looking absurd. Mamash like Ahasuerus. And drugs are maybe the most obvious example, and in certain ways the most extreme example. And drugs, you know, marijuana and heroin do not have redeeming value, other than medical marijuana in various particular contexts. But there are all sorts of other appetites that we have that are at times appropriate and are at times inappropriate. Whether it's a sexual appetite, whether it's an appetite for food, or whatever other tanugo mazah, which one can embark on in a happy, healthy, holy way, or in an unfettered, uncontrolled, unholy way. And often we think that we'll be more free if we're undisciplined. Then we'll be in total control of ourselves, because we can do whatever we want. But the Ahasuerus, the sketch of Ahasuerus in Perek Aleph is an important reminder that you'll be ein lecha mincha misha osik b'Torah. If you live a life of self-control, self-discipline, powered by the messages of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you end up being more free. If you live a life of free love or free whatever else, where you think there's this illusion that just doing whatever I like without any rules will make me more free, as Ahasuerus discovered, you end up being shackled and you end up looking absurd. That's, I think, one of the larger messages. If Purim is the yontif of Kabbalah's Torah Shebaal Peh, as Tosis suggests, that the aspect of Kafalei and Har Kegigas was specifically Torah Shebaal Peh, which they had not accepted Belev Shalem at the time of Mount Har Sinai, and that's what they accepted specifically Belev Shalem Kimu VeKiblu. They accepted Torah Shebaal Peh Belev Shalem at the time of the Torah of Hakadosh Baruch Hu Behester, at the time of the Nes of Purim. So it's an important lesson. If this is one of the major Yom Tov of Kabbalah Satorah, it's an important lesson. It really is profoundly true. Real happiness and real freedom and real self-actualization and satisfaction will come through adopting a posture of self-control and of engaging Olam HaZeh in a way which I'm in charge. I flip the switch. I decide whether I want to engage or not, and I'm in charge of my Olam HaZeh rather than my Olam HaZeh being in charge of me. So I think, again, as I said before, this is dealing with a lot of the details and with the Malbim's incredible Midas touch for making us notice so many little details in the Pesukim and then weaving it into one bigger picture. Then, as I suggested, this may also speak to a larger theme that flows from this parak.